Yesterday evening at the last sitting, I read a poem that I introduced as a bridge poem between Diana's topic yesterday on the happiness of related to the hindrances, and today's topic, the happiness related to concentration or samadhi. And I'd like to, those of you who weren't there, and for those of you who might have forgotten, I want to reread a part of it and so continue this bridging of the two topics. So this is a poem by Galway Kahnel. It's called Saint Francis and the Sow. And the first half of it goes like this. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on the flower and retell it in words and in touch. It is lovely until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. So this thing about flowering from within, to somehow connect to yourself, be with yourself, be present here in a way that is a kind of a self-blessing. Some of you, I'm sure the word blessing doesn't really mean much. But with a certain kind of, and if you're been around Buddhism a lot, you're then troubled already that Gill is using the word self. But the kind regard, the generous approach to seeing ourselves, being with ourselves, some way of being that nourishes, nurtures, allows the loveliness in us to blossom and to grow, the loveliness that we all have that sometimes hasn't been seen, we haven't seen it for ourselves, we don't know it. Sometimes it helps for it to be recognized from the outside, so we can find it in ourselves. And this is important because when we get to concentration, samadhi, this has a lot to do with a radically different way of being than we usually go about our life. A radically different perspective, a radically different approach, where some of the things that shift is, for example, we're not goal-oriented so much, trying to make something happen. We're not focusing on fixing something, engineering something, chasing after things we want, trying to avoid what we don't want. It's an orientation where the stronger reification, constriction, coagulation around self begins to dissipate because it's not so much about the self anymore. One way or the other, most people going around in life, things are often centered around some conceit, some approach, some idea, something here of who they are that they're navigating and negotiating and. You know, I think for many people, they themselves are the main subject of many of their thoughts, main character of their stories they tell themselves. And with this samadhi, there's a shift that begins to happen. It's not complete, but there's a shift that begins to happen that it's no longer self-centric, even though it might be situation-centric. We're centering ourselves in a situation that's here and happens to be in this body, in this time, this place. So it's situation-centric, but it's not the same as self-centric that so much of life is organized around. So there's a shift. And then rather than from the outside in trying to change things, there's a blossoming, there's an emerging of something that we kind of get out of the way of, that we allow. And if we're too busy engineering, fixing, judging, improving the self, criticizing the self, that there's no room for making space for something to blossom, to arise from within. So we're looking at a different way. So here's a story. There was this very wise person, an old sage living deep, deep in the mountains, who knew the secret of happiness. But you had to make your way to see this person. Not many people would go, and some people were skeptics, you know, the secret for happiness. There's no happiness to be had. There's no secret. I used to have to win the California lottery. That's all it takes, or some equivalent. But a few people would go, make their way, and the person would listen to their story, their life, and say, okay, yeah. There is a place where there is happiness for you to find. And here's how you can find it. You'll find it if you take this path, this road that goes east. And on that road, you'll find it. But you have to just keep walking until you find it. So people will start walking on this road, going east. And most people think they'll find it in a few hours. And they're looking behind the trees and under the little footpath bridges and behind the boulders. And maybe just around the next bend, that's where I'll find the happiness. But they don't find it the first day, and so they sleep someplace and start the next day, and they're still looking and searching. And must be up ahead somewhere soon. And they keep going and going, and they come to the foot of a mountain. Oh, it must be the top of the mountain. That's kind of the archetypical idea of spirituality, is to go up the top of the mountain. So that's what the wise person must have meant. So they hike up to the top of the mountain, but they don't find it there. Maybe it's on the other side of the mountain. So they take the path and keep going and going. So it goes on now for some days, for weeks, for months. But they remember the sage said, you just have to keep walking. And after a while, in the beginning, they're exhausted and sore from all the walking. And after a while, their body gets more in shape, and their breathing gets more into it. And after a while, they just kind of get into the rhythm of walking. And sometimes they even forget that they're looking for happiness. And they're just walking. And after a while, it just feels really good to walk. It's like things are harmonious. It feels like they're walking kind of in harmony with the world around them, maybe. It just they've forgotten about their concerns in life. They've forgotten about all the suffering they had for not winning 52 California lotteries in a row. And all kind, whatever it might be. And after a while, they just kind of look forward to getting up in the morning to start walking. It's so much pleasure just walking. It's like after a while, all they're about is walking. And then they realize at some point, wow, I've never known this amount of happiness. And they found the happiness. The happiness was not found in any place along the walk. It wasn't a thing that somewhere along the way you could find the happiness. The happiness was found in the walking. That's where it was found. So the happiness of concentration is not finding something, attaining something, but rather a kind of surrendering to the activity of practice. And to keep doing it, walking that path, keep doing it. Sometimes it takes a lot of familiarity, doing it over and over again, until we begin to kind of forget about things. We kind of put aside looking for an answer, looking to fix something. We even sometimes kind of begin to forget ourselves. I'm such a lousy meditator. I'll never attain anything. I can't do it. But you keep doing it anyway. And after a while, just the doing of it, the engagement with it. At first, it's kind of hard. You get out of shape, out of breath, get kind of sore. But after a while, things acclimatize. And some of the things that were difficult in the beginning begin to kind of work themselves out. The kinks work themselves out. And so it's like, just show up and do it. And do it, and do it. And at some point, it's in the doing, being absorbed in the doing, undistracted from the doing, not trying to do something different than just the simple mindfulness of breathing, just simple mindfulness of this, simple kind of absorption in this activity, whether it's washing the dishes or eating the food. Or opening one of those doors so quietly that no one ever hears. Just absorb just this activity. So here's a story. Until the pandemic, I would make regular visits to a local state prison called San Quentin. And this was written by one of the prisoners that I met there. My night was like any other night. It was 8 p.m., time for close custody count. Parentheses, all prisons have institutional counts, wherein they count each prisoner's body to ensure no one is missing or has escaped. Not being there for count is considered a serious violation, unquote, and parentheses. The officer came to our cell and called my bunkie's name, after which he gave him the last two digits of his prison number. The same went for me. Half an hour passed, and a neighbor comes to my cell and said they were paging me downstairs. I had not heard them calling for me. I went down to the podium, and the cops said to me, "Why were you not in your cell for count?" And I told them, "I was in my cell for count, as I have been every day and night for 12 years. And I have numerous neighbors that can verify that." It did not matter what I said. The cops told me to not do it again. And I am like, whatever. 2 days go by, and I found out that the sergeant gave me a write-up that is a violation. I'm thinking, okay, I truly am not guilty of this, and I have many witnesses who will say the same. However, at the hearing, a cop that counted said he looked in the cell 2 times, and I was not there. It did not matter what I said or how many people I had who would say the same, because I was found guilty and given 40 hours of extra work. I said to myself, screw this. I'm not going to do the work. This is so unfair. I did nothing wrong, and these guys are wrong about this. I watched that count cop count me, and he did not look up from his count board once. His eyes never left that board. I filed a complaint against the officer. That is the last thing I wanted to do, But I was not wrong about this. They were. I felt bitter about being ordered to do those 40 hours of extra work. In a phone call, I spoke to my mother about it, and she wondered if I could perhaps just take it, and regardless of the circumstances and the injustice of it, see if I could do what would ultimately be best for me. She said she would accept what I would decide, but if I could, to act respectfully. I reckoned if I refused to do the work, even though it came about unjustly, I would be guilty in their eyes. I chose to do the work anyway. I've always prided myself with doing exceptional work, and I was desperately looking to find my pride in this situation, somewhere no matter what. So not only did I do the work, I did the best possible job I could do. I was asked to shine up this brass fire hydrant. Though I still felt resentful about those 40 hours of extra duty, I set off to shine up this hydrant, and I really got into the job. As a result, this hydrant started shining very brightly. As the sun caught it, I could see my face in it, and I noticed I was smiling from ear to ear. I began to laugh out loud for no reason other than enjoying that moment and seeing the result of my work. By putting all my conscious effort into shining up that fire hydrant, I'd become bigger than the unfairness that led me to my assignment. I do not know how long I was at it, but when I was done, that hydrant, it looked like the prettiest thing in the whole prison. Kind of like a small lighthouse standing proudly in an ocean of concrete, calling out on how to steer, on how to move through the place. I realized I was shining too, and it hasn't left me. Many people commented on that hydrant all week, wondering how come that thing gives off so much light all of a sudden. I just smiled. And his prison name is the same as a bird man. I don't know his legal name. So it's a little bit problematic the way that prisoners are treated in California. More than a little bit, it's awful. Life is sometimes awful in all kinds of ways. And for him, he decided that he would not be limited by or pressed by the injustice of the situation. And he gave himself over to the activity he had to do. Remember in the beginning of the retreat, I talked about that one of the analogies for concentration, for mindfulness, is to take a cloth to polish a metal bowl. So here he's polishing the fire hydrant. So to take our mindfulness and really be present, not with any strain, not for a purpose so that we could do something, but just to walk the road, just to do the activity of being present for this. And we keep doing it and doing it and doing it until things get kind of settled and organized, and we begin, because we're absorbing ourselves in the activity that we're doing, the distracted mind doesn't pull us away, doesn't split our attention, doesn't fragment us into the past, the future, the judgments, the agendas we have. The mind, in a certain way, becomes simple, very simple. Just this, walking down the steps here, just walking down the steps. How many of you, by the time you go from here to your meditation spot to the steps, and start going down the steps, have already thinking of universes, of stories, ideas, things are going to do, you know? I know I've done that. But what if when you walk down the steps, It's just walking the steps. The whole universe becomes just the steps in that narrow space, stepping. Is that reasonable to do? Is that ridiculous? And it's important things to think about, right? All kinds of important things to do in our life. And we have to kind of get on with thinking and planning and figuring it out. And you just wasted a whole session of meditation, not thinking enough. So you have to catch up now. Is that really the best use of this precious life you have? You might say yes. I'm not going to knock it. But I wanted to say, as I started this talk, there is a whole other almost paradigm, a very different orientation of how to live life. That's also a possibility, that's also valuable, that in the Buddhist world, it sometimes is called an unlimited life, meaning a life which is not limited or constricted. And the analogies that Diana had yesterday for being free of the hindrances, one of them was to be free from prison, from jail, that limitation of, there's some way of being caught in aversion, caught in anger, hostility, that's kind of like prison. Or being filled with desire and pursuing desire is kind of like a debt, being in debt. And then to be no longer be caught in that hindrance is being free of debt. I associated with myself, I'm kind of a, you know, for me, desires are a dime a dozen. They're real easy. I'm more of a desire kind of person than an aversive person, I think. And so it's very easy. So, but I've seen when I was younger how having all these desires was exhausting for me. And that's where the debt was for me. The debt was in my, I needed to rest, I needed to recover. And I was now in debt to myself, in a sense. And I've learned through this practice that if I don't kind of live in my desires, pursuing my desires, focusing on my desires, that I don't get as tired as I used to do when I was younger. Things are just, I have much more energy. I'm not in debt. So these hindrances limit us. This other approach is to discover something that's unlimited, is to discover a different way of being, living in this world, which is well worth knowing. It increases the range of possibilities. So we can kind of not be always dealing with our problems, working with our issues, working, living this life in a smaller, narrower, constricted bandwidth or, you know, channel. But there's other channels to be in. And one of those channels are the happiness channels, discovering how to be happy. And there's a happiness that comes from really when you do something, just really do that thing. Really be present for that and let everything else fall away. I learned a lot about this in Zen training, because in Zen training, that was one of the specialties that that when you do something, really just do it, be really there for it. And I remember some of the things they asked me to do in the monastery, I did not want to do. But I had these, the first job I was given in the monastery, they had these platforms like this, like I'm sitting up here, but they went all the way around the room. The wooden platforms. So the room was much, maybe twice the size of this, maybe, or I don't know. And that's everyone sat on the platform, but on the edges of the room. And when I got there, the platforms had just been made. They were brand new. They hadn't been installed even. And the wood was rough. And I spent my first 3 months in the monastery sanding the tops of those platforms. That was my official, you know, I should get my certificate in Zen training. Should be a sanding, electric sander. And this was not my idea of why I came to a Zen monastery. to work. We have this all day long. But I learned that not liking it, resisting it, limited me, diminished me. And I learned that if I got distracted, I didn't do the job very well, and I have to go back and redo pieces of it. And I learned slowly over those 3 months to just sand. Just be there and do the activity of sanding and sanding and sanding. And I got happy. Not dramatically happy. Nothing to write home about. But it became satisfying. It became, well, this is, you know, and I would come and, okay, this is what I'm doing. Just do this. My mind would wander off and, okay, back, come back, come back. Just do this, do this. And so the long road of practice. Maybe it's best to think the practice road is forever. There's no end. And you got to just walk the endless road. But it's in the walking that when you absorb yourself in the walking, engage yourself in the practice, that there's such a happiness that's to be found in the doing, not in the attaining. And that happiness of the doing is something that emerges, that comes with being in harmony with it, with being graceful with it, being in a certain healthy way, surrendering to it and not resisting it or being ahead of yourself or just being there for it in the simplicity of this moment of what we're doing. And so that's part of this, the happiness of samadhi. The other part of the happiness of samadhi, there's two that I want to talk about today. One is this of just the activity of being absorbed in what we're doing. The other is is to include all of ourselves. Nothing left out. And part of the traditional understanding of samadhi is that it involves a unification. It involves a gathering together of all of who we are. And I love this idea of gathering together. You know, at some point, humans were known to be hunters and gatherers. Some people still are, very much so. But because in Buddhism, we put a tremendous emphasis on being harmless, not killing. So the hunting doesn't work. But gathering, and go gather acorns, gather plants, gather for the family, for the tribe. It's a caring, nurturing thing to do. It's gathering everything together and bringing rather than fighting, rather than fight or flight. There's approaching and nurturing. We have this instinct for fight or flight, they say. Just as much as we have that instinct, we have the instinct to approach and soothe. And so this gathering together I associate with gathering everything into a kind of nice basket. So it's all there to nourish us, support ourselves, to be here. It's all included. All of us is included. And so when we start getting kind of present, there's all these things like, not that. If only this wasn't here, then I could practice. If only my knees didn't hurt, then I just have it made, then I could really practice. If only that chainsaw over there wasn't happening, then I could practice. If only they had served more chocolate chip cookies every day, then I could practice. If only, you know, if something was differently, or, you know. But the approach of this unification is whatever's happening, there's a healthy way of doing this which takes the form of this too. This too is included. This too is here. So to include everything in the field of mindfulness, in the recognition, in the knowing. So that has two meanings. One is if there's a loud sound outside, a chainsaw or blower, whatever it was, that this too is part of what I include. My teacher in Burma, one of the great teachers of the 20th century there in Burma, when he started his meditation, he had a roommate. And this teacher of mine, Upandita, was kind of like a was really a tough kind of, I don't know, warrior type guy. And so if he's going to meditate, he's really going to meditate. So he was going to stay up late at night in his bed meditating. But his roommate would go to bed early and snore. And he was indignant. How could he be so lazy, you know, and he's disturbing my meditation by his snoring. And it was a struggle for him. Until one day, he said this too to the snoring. And then became mindful of the sound of snoring. And the unification happened. He was no longer fighting something. He was no longer resisting it. He was no longer trying to avoid it. He took it in and he got absorbed. He got settled. He became focused, concentrated on the man snoring. And he said, my teacher said, that was the beginning of entering into a world of meditation. He was just learning it, and that was the beginning. So this too, and include everything. Oh, this too I can be mindful of. This too I'll be mindful of. So there's always this too. That's part of the gathering together and unification. But the other part is unification, is this of beginning to gather together all the different faculties we have within, so they're all operating together for the same purpose. They're the same activity. So what I mean for this is, for example, I'm quite capable of sitting down to meditate with the intention, I'm going to really stay with my breath today and not waver. This is my intention. But I just got an email from someone that really irritated me. So my thinking mind is now thinking about, you know, how am I going to reply to this email? But it's, you know, I didn't have much breakfast. And lunch is soon. And my stomach has another idea besides meditating or besides emails. And so part of me is thinking about, well, what's for lunch? And what should I make for lunch? And I better start thinking about lunch. But then also I have this very important meeting in the afternoon that I'm a little worried about. And so part of me is like planning the meeting and rehearsing for it. And so I can go on and on, just like how split my mind becomes. But, you know, there's my emotions are with the irritation. My body is with the hunger. My intention is trying to be with the breath. My fear is with the meeting. And they're all going in different directions. Samadhi, the happiness of samadhi, is starting to gather these things together. So they're all kind of working together on the same project. So if the project is to just stay with the breathing, or stay with the walking when doing walking meditation, then to gently, lovingly invite all of who you are, come here, settle down here, be here. It doesn't work to jerk your mind around. It doesn't work to kind of be hostile, but to recognize you have these different faculties. And so in mindfulness practice, we find the most compelling, predominant experience. So we don't fighting that, at least. And then we begin gathering ourselves around there. So rather than the attention being attention, intention being staying on the breath, the intention now is to be with the sound of the saw. And then instead of thinking about dinner, I recognize, yes, I'm hungry. Now with a hungry body, with a body and stomach that's hungry, how can I invite in the sound into that body and be part of it all? So that, and then if I'm thinking so much, I can't stop thinking. So let me gently, calmly think kind of a little bit about the sound of the saw. Let me see. I might say to myself, let me see. What does it feel like when it hits my eardrums? Do I hear the vibrations of the saw anywhere else in my body? What kind of impact does it have on my emotions to feel the saw? And so I'm starting to gather together myself here. So the different faculties are all operating together here for this. It's not so easy to do, but that's the direction we're going. And a little bit it works like a magnet. When I was a kid, we go in the sandbox at school with a little magnet, and we would run it across the sand, and they had all these little iron, little pieces of iron, flint ore or something, and they'd all line up. It was kind of fun to do. So the same thing, was just stay with your breathing, trust it if you, unless something else is really clear. And then with time, as you keep relaxing and settling in and relaxing, it kind of gathers you together, and you're here, present. And part of this allowing and gathering together is not only what you offer in terms of your attention, but it's also what you offer in terms of the space that you also offer to allow something to surface. Allow something to blossom, to flower. Everything will flower. Everything flowers from self-blessing. And here is a very important distinction that the Buddha makes. And I talked about Sunday at IMC, so some of you might have heard this. There are different modes by which we can know the world or be connected to the world. One is through our reactivity, and the other is through what emerges from deep inside. For the Buddha, the reactivity is called, it has to do with feelings and sensations, experiences we can have that are of the flesh, that have to do with our senses being stimulated from the outside, kind of. And so it's relatively surface stuff. And it's reactive because our system is being triggered by something outside of ourselves, being triggered by something. And then we react to that triggering. It isn't only up from outside, but there's also the kind of the surface things of the flesh where I have a thought, and that thought is almost like outside. It's like, that was unpleasant, and I react to it. Oh, that's bad. Let me not have that. Or that's painful. Let me blame someone. Because some people, that's an attempt to get away from one's own pain, is to blame or attack something outside. Or whatever it might be, these are all what are called reactions. The alternative that the Buddha talks about is the feelings that arise that are not of the flesh, carnal or not carnal. Some people translate this distinction between worldly and spiritual. It's very hard to know what the right way to say this in English, but my way is the reactive side of our life and the emerging side, that which emerges. And the example of what can emerge, what can flower from within is very that's one of the clearest examples of this has to do with samadhi, with concentration. And that is, there's a calm, large mountain lake, and there's no rain falling in it, and there's no streams flowing into it. So there's nothing disturbing it from the outside. But there is fresh water entering the lake from an underwater spring, and it replenishes the lake, refreshes the lake with this gentle flow of fount, like an underwater fountain of water, that's fresh water that comes out of the springs and moves throughout the whole lake. That way, the same way, samadhi begins to release, open up a self-blessing, a flowering of something from the inside out. That can only happen when we kind of relax and open so that all of who we are is included. This might include being open and allowing yourself to feel that which is really difficult to feel. The things that are painful, grief and anger and despair, fear. And to learn slowly how to wisely, carefully, keep opening this too. This too I include. Not so much to resolve the difficulties, which maybe you can do, but remember, just walking the road is what's important. Not just to keep opening, be mindful, but this opening the space inside so that there's enough space to even hold what's difficult and painful. To do that, then also that space now is available for the self-blessing. It's available for the flowering of something that can come. And that space is the space of awareness, the space of attention. We're making breathing room for our life. We're making room to be inclusive of all, everything, all of who we are. It's phenomenally respectful for who we are to include everything. And we start learning in that process of samadhi, developing samadhi, and so being really, starting to get really continuous, absorbed in activity we're doing. We learn a lot about how we don't do that. And that's one of the very important things to learn. So if you can't get concentrated, congratulations. It's not your turn. It's your turn to discover why you can't, to understand what's going on there. It's a really important lesson. But as you start to get settled, you start seeing, oh, I was kind of present, but now see, I'm thinking about my high school, that teacher that was so difficult. And I can see how I'm leaving the present moment and getting wrapped up in some other world. And I can feel that difference. Now I'm having fantasies about cookies. And when are they going to serve cookies again? And I can feel the separation from my direct experience. I'm leaving into kind of a two-dimensional virtual world of cookies and imagination. And I feel that, I feel how that feels. I start getting involved with my challenges in my life without diminishing that there are challenges. But you can start feeling, as I start thinking those challenges, the walls come close in. Things get more obscure, nearer, tighter in my mind. And so we start seeing the effect of certain modes of being are, because we're being mindful, we're being inclusive. This too, Oh, so this is how it's like. I'm thinking about cookies, and when I do that, this too. Oh, now I see. In thinking about cookies, how it disconnected me. I started thinking about my challenges, I really limited the scope of my mindfulness, my present moment experience. So learning how this unfolds and how this works is phenomenally important for this practice. It's part of the walking the road, just seeing. And then, as you start seeing how this works, how the mind plays its games, then we start seeing, and it becomes easier and more natural for things to settle. We're including everything, and then okay, this too. Let's settle with this. Let's relax with this. And more, everything starts finding its place. Everything kind of just gathers together. Imagine a big basket. The mind is, the heart is a huge basket, and everything gets find its it ends up in the basket, rolling down the edges of the basket and settling at the bottom. Everything comes together. And there is where the seeds blossoms, the buds can begin to show. There's space for the self blossoming that's within, for something to emerge. And without making, allowing for space for something to emerge, we don't know what it's going to be. But for the Buddha, it's samadhi that allows something deep to emerge. Emerge. For me, when I was started to meditate after some time, what emerged for me was something I had never experienced before that caught my attention. And that changed my life, that set me on the path of Dharma practice. And that was, and that, I don't know what I really meant back then with this word, but it was the only word I had, was I started discovering integrity. I didn't get concentrated in any kind of classic way. I didn't know about that. My mind didn't get really quiet. I didn't know that. I didn't have any idea that your mind was supposed to become quiet when you meditate. I was so lucky not to know that. So, but I just kept showing up. This too, this too, this too. And then something emerged. Something appeared slowly. And I think I called it integrity because not because I was now ethical, not that kind of integrity, but because I became one. There was a feeling of being whole that I never had before, or hardly ever had in my life. And this feeling of being whole felt that this is right. This is a way forward. Any other way of being was to be partial, to be limited, to be fragmented. And even though there was a lot of authority or messages that I was supposed to pursue the different things that made me fragmented, I decided, no, I want to pursue this being whole. This too is included. This too we hold here. Moment after moment, this is what's this now. With that, and one of the ways to lose that, and this is what we learn also, because we have to learn it for ourselves, is we lose it by retroactive thinking. Something happens, and then we start thinking about it. There's the loud saw across the street. I get irritated. And then I start thinking, oh, yes, irritation. It's a regular thing for me. I keep getting irritated. And why am I irritated? And why didn't they know that I'm an irritable person when they decided where to put a retreat center? They have known that people were going to use a saw across the street. And I'm, you know, why? And why do I keep doing this? And what just happened? How did I get caught there? That's retroactive thinking. And I've lost the movement of, oh, this too I'll include. And this too I include doesn't mean that you're now stuck with that kind of thinking. It means that you're opening up so that you're not stuck. So you're not reinforcing it and repeating it and being in the loop of it. It actually is the way to, the movement towards freedom, this too. And this Birdman, he talks about, he became so big. The movement towards becoming big, to have enough space for everything, and to be settled in the middle of it. And to have a wholeness, becoming whole or integrity or something, that maybe it's not your idea of happiness, see, what you use the word happiness to refer to, or joy to refer to, but there's something very satisfying, a kind of well-being, a kind of rightness, a kind of coming at home, maybe here, all here. And because everything is included, you're there to respect everything. Nothing's being dismissed. Nothing needs to be dismissed. It's just something else to be aware of, to be present for. This too. So there's the happiness of just doing the practice on that long road, but you'll find the happiness if you just walk that road. But don't look behind the bushes for it. Just keep walking. Just keep doing it. And then there's the happiness of being absorbed in what you do, but an absorption which doesn't push anything away, but just keeps opening and including, gathering together, gathering the mind here. Yeah, this too. Let's be present for this. Where there's space and a possibility for something that's not you, you're doing, your efforts, you're figuring it out, you're fixing it. Something that's within you can self-flower, a self-blessing can emerge, can blossom from within. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on the flower and retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely. Until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. So maybe you're the bud. May this whole retreat and this whole community here together, may it teach you, reteach you your loveliness. So maybe you will blossom from within. Thank you.